Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see? You start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. And you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar. Delicious. And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. I'll be with you for the next hour. Thanks so much for tuning in. Before I introduce our guests, I have to say, this is Mouthful's 13th anniversary. Can't believe I've been doing this show for 13 years. It's really, really something to think about. You know, in many years for Mouthful's anniversary, we've had a big party, we've had film nights, we've had all kinds of various ways to celebrate the show. We're going to do something, but we're not doing it real close to the anniversary this year. It's just something, this is a little tease, you could say. Sometime in 2009, probably the first part, we're going to have some sort of really good mouthful bash. So there's just a little something to look forward to. And now we're on our way to Australia. Well, welcome to Mouthful. It is great to be able to have you here on the show. I'm not sure if I've had guests from Australia yet. Had guests from lots of parts of the world, but it's really nice to have someone from down under. So, Paul Wilson, thank you very much for being here.
It's great to be here.
And also, just over the mountain, Morgan Norman. Did I get that right?
Yes.
From Greg Norman Estates,
yes.
Over in St. Helena.
Yep.
And one thing about Australia that anyone who's interested in food or works in that big profession of food knows that Australia has been doing wonderful things, has been on the map of foodies for a very long time. Chuck Williams of Williams-Sonoma always refers to Australia Vogue. Australia Gourmet? One of the food magazines.
Yeah, Gourmet Traveller and Vogue Entertainment, they're the two big ones.
Okay, yeah, that. So it is Vogue, yeah, as the best magazines with the best photography, the best production values. So, and I know I get a lot of cookbooks in the mail from Australian authors, and the photography is always so gorgeous. And now you have a book out.
That's right.
And it is Botanical, Inside the Iconic Brasserie.
Yes, it's a book about the restaurant where I work, and it's a bit of an institution in Melbourne, Victoria. They call it the Bot in Melbourne. It used to be a hotel, as in a pub. Mm-hmm. It got renovated 5 years ago, and it's got a sleek, modern brasserie, I guess. But it's kind of a watering hole for Melburnians, and it's very close to the Botanical Gardens and near the MCG, the big stadium there. So it's close to the CBD, so it's a real sort of a greeting and meeting point where people celebrate on every level.
And how long have you been involved with it?
5 years now.
Okay, so you came after the renovation.
That's right, yeah.
Where were you before that?
I was running the Park Hyatt Hotel in Melbourne also as the executive chef.
Mm-hmm. I think that the title of the book, Botanical, and is an interesting name for a restaurant.
Yeah.
Is it because, in part, obviously, because of the botanical gardens?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
It's directly opposite, yeah.
Uh-huh. And what makes it such an iconic place?
I just think it's in a very good area. South Yarra in Melbourne is kind of where the rich and famous live, if you like. So it's like the canteen for the rich and famous. So everyone's celebrated there or had their first drink or met their wife or had a punch-up or something, you know, extraordinary in their life has happened at the Bot. So it's kind of a famous place for that reason.
Okay, cool. What I'd like to do is put the cuisine in perspective, particularly from the point of view of sense of place in Australia. And we have brasseries here. Mm. You know, lots of us have been to brasseries in Paris and all over the place. But what makes it uniquely of that area?
think essentially it's a brasserie which appeals to everyone on a different level. It's open for breakfast, lunch and dinner 7 days, where most brasseries are sort of primarily a dinner business in Australia. So it really is a restaurant for the community, mm-hmm. as well as the corporate crowd at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't really find many brasseries open for breakfast.
Yeah.
What do you serve?
Just really good, healthy breakfast. It's a real melting pot of everything, really, because it's a real... You have sort of real estate agents in the area. You have people jogging around the town. That's the botanical gardens. You mm-hmm. have... you know, local residents just popping in for a coffee and a croissant. So the menu is really diverse, and there's something there for everyone.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your favourite things?
I guess the famous scrambled eggs, rocket scrambled eggs. We scrambled eggs, and we add fresh wild rocket to the eggs as they cook. So you have a lovely, fragrant, nutty flavour to mm-hmm. the eggs. Yeah.
And people, I think, here now know rocket as arugula.
That's right.
More than rocket. I love the name rocket. I think it's great.
Yes.
And it grows, you have access to wild?
Absolutely, yeah. All the produce in Melbourne grows sort of 2-3 hours from the restaurant. It's very close to us.
Uh-huh. And so do you work with farmers and foragers?
Very much so. Uh-huh. Australia doesn't import hardly anything, really, mm-hmm. except for wine, I guess. Not a lot of that either, but it's primarily a community-based sort of society where we grow a lot of our own produce and promote our own. And like here in California, with the organic movement's really moving forward. Mm-hmm. It's a very exciting time for us.
Mm-hmm. I just opened this book, and I have to say, this book is absolutely gorgeous. This photograph of figs is so beautiful. I could frame it and hang it on my wall. And I see it's an interesting recipe, spiced lamb-stuffed figs with baba ganoush and sumac dressing. I love sumac, but you don't see it here very often, and I associate it mostly with North Africa. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I mean, the food in Melbourne is really influenced by the community. There's a huge Lebanese community in Melbourne, mm-hmm. and there's some great... authentic restaurants. So as sort of enthusiastic cooks, we like to sort of work with what's around us mm-hmm. and ingredients we haven't used before. I was trained in London and Europe, but it's very French and I guess the kind of common haute cuisine. And moving to Australia, you can kind of really loosen up a little bit and sort of work with what's around you and the influences of the ingredients around you. And because there's so many Lebanese people, mm-hmm. there's great Lebanese ingredients, great figs and you know, really good pomegranates, and so it mm-hmm. makes sense to work with those flavors and cook in that way.
Mm-hmm. What about the sumac? Can you tell me what it's like? I love the flavor of it, and I know it as za'atar.
Yeah, it's a member of the juniper berry family, so it's like a really sort of fragrant, salty flavor. Really, mm-hmm. It's got really good sort of merits with lamb and some oily fish.
Almost has sort of a tanginess,
yeah,
a little like lemon to it.
That's right. It's got a bit of acid, which is mm-hmm. so it's really good with rich, oily fish or lamb or duck. Absolutely, it's uh-huh. like a real sweet and sour contrast. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, what made you decide to do a book?
I guess the restaurant itself is very successful, and the team who work there are really hardworking, great people, and it felt like it was a right thing to do, sort of celebrate the restaurant and the success of the restaurant mm-hmm. and all the people that work there. And as a chef, I guess it's always your ambition to write a book. And,
sure.
And to link it to a great sort of iconic venue in Australia seemed like a good opportunity and something I could look back at my life and think was a great achievement, I guess.
Uh-huh. How did you feel about the process of doing the book? Did you like that?
It was an eye-opener. Most chefs were not the most organized people in some regard. Certainly with
neither are writers, trust me.
Certainly with documenting recipes, it's a very sort of free-spirited thing. Mm-hmm. Certainly for our publisher, it had to be very structured. So it was a good process, good discipline, and mm-hmm. The whole kitchen became highly organized because of the book.
Mm-hmm. So the kitchen all worked together on...
Yeah. It's all the recipes from the menu, so... It was just basically scaled them down for 4 people and mm-hmm. you know, and created these exact recipes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk some more about some of the recipes. And you were here. You did a dinner in San Francisco earlier in the week, I think. Is that right?
Last night, yeah.
And when people hear the show, it'll actually be about 5 or 6 days ago. So where was the dinner?
The name of the restaurant escapes me, I have to be honest, because I'm still finding my feet around the the city, but
McCormick and Schmitz.
That's it, McCormick and Schmitz.
Okay,
yeah.
You want to talk about the menu?
Yeah, it was really just promoting our cuisine in Victoria and how diverse it is. So we did a kind of some oysters with some Vietnamese flavours. We have a large Vietnamese community, so it was a fragrant dressing made with lime and fish sauce and roasted prawn shells and Vietnamese mint.
Mm,
and
sounds good.
Very fragrant. And then we had sort of North African Moorish-style crab salad, so crushed avocado with harissa, fresh Dungeness crab, gazpacho dressing, and some tahini. So very
salt.
That's
a real interesting combination.
Yeah, crab and spices are kind of what, if you think about crab, chili crab in Singapore and Sri Lankan crab curry, and the spices.
Salt and pepper crab in Malaysia.
That's right, yeah. So they're kind of crab-like spices, so it kind of works in that regard, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then we did something quite European, because there's some great bistros and French restaurants in Melbourne, so we did a classic steak au poivre, peppered steak, with caramelised shallots and spinach and anchovy puree, and you know, great beef here, so it made sort of sense to use the beef you have here.
And plus, your steak au poivre, you're down in the area, well, not all that far from you, where so many good peppercorns are grown.
That's
Peppercorn from the peppercorns from Malaysia are just so phenomenal.
Yeah, and you dry roast them, and they're terrific with the Shiraz and Cabernet wine. It really brings out the flavours of the wine, so it's a good sort of match-up too. And then we finished with a really sort of simple dessert, a cappuccino creme brulee, which is just a, I guess, I don't really like the dessert myself, I have to say, because it's so popular at the restaurant, you kind of get a little bit over it, but people love it, and it's just a beautiful creme brulee flavour with hazelnuts and espresso, and it's topped with a Sabayon, a frothy coffee Sabayon, goes with biscotti and a small donut.
Now, is that one of the dishes at the restaurant that your customers won't let you take off the menu?
Exactly right. Yeah.
Yep, there's a lot of those.
It's a crowd pleaser.
Yes. I would like to bring you in, Norman. Norman. Morgan, I know that. What has been your role in all this?
Well, my father, Greg Norman, started Greg Norman Estates, and being Australian, we originally started with an Australian line of wine and ventured over into California. So I have come into the scheme of things and have kind of taken over and running his side of it, tasting the wine for his perspective and kind of giving his eyes and ears to the wine. And I'm half Australian, so it's really kind of an honor to be a part of the whole Victoria, Australia here in San Francisco, and to obviously dine last night with Paul's food was fabulous. And we got the opportunity to pair the wine with each of the dishes last night. So with the oysters, we got to do the sparkling Greg Norman Estates that we have from Victoria. Our Pinot Noir and Chardonnay come from Victoria. Uh-huh. And so it was just an extremely rare opportunity to eat such amazing Australian food in California.
Yeah. Now, you say you're half Australian.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you born?
I was born in Florida,
okay.
Moved to Australia when I was 2 weeks old. My mother's American and my father's Australian.
Uh-huh. So you did live there for a while?
I did, yep, lived there for a while and then pretty much grew up in the United States, but with my father being so iconic Australian, our household, our culture, everything was very Australian, so in my heart I feel pulled towards that.
Well, it's a nice opportunity then for the two of you to work together. Should remind you, you are listening to Mouthful here on KRCP. My guest, it's the Australian connection tonight. We're talking about a beautiful book, Botanical, Inside the Iconic Brasserie by Paul Wilson. We also have in the studio with us Morgan Norman. I don't know why that is being such a tongue twister, but it is. It happens to me now and then. Listeners know that. They put up with me, it seems. I want to talk some about the area of Melbourne, but I want to preface it with my fascination with Australia. I've been a member of Bat Conservation International for a very long time, and there are often articles in the newsletter about bats. There's a river that you go down, and I think the only way to get there is down this river to an incredible colony of Australian fruit bats. So most of what I know about Australia has come from reading about the fruit bats there. So that said, what can you tell me about, where Melbourne is in relationship to this sort of thing, or are the bats all over? And then just more about the agriculture and viticulture.
Well, there's certainly a large community of bats in Melbourne. Coming from England, I've never really seen a bat before.
And now you see the big, huge ones.
They're like, you know, they're like as common as pigeons in England, you know, so they're everywhere. And they seem to sort of migrate in the summer and hang around, literally, it's a bit of a cliche, but big old churches and big old trees near churches. And the Botanical Gardens in Melbourne has this really fantastic sort of rainforest. They've recreated the rainforest mm-hmm. in Victoria. The climate's very different in Melbourne to most of Australia. Mm-hmm. You have four seasons, and it's quite cool. So they have this kind of, I guess, rainforest area that seems to attract all the bats in Melbourne. They congregate around the gardens and then move around the city. Mm-hmm. And they breed, as you probably know, quite readily. Mm-hmm. And so hence why we have quite a lot of bats in Melbourne.
And how do people who live there feel about them? Are they happy about them, or are they considered a pest?
Not a pest at all, no.
Oh, good.
It's part of the kind of fun of living in Melbourne. A bat just goes over your head. Uh-huh. And the noise they make is quite unusual. And it's, again, I guess I'm a little bit biased because I find it still quite exciting being an Englishman living in Australia to sort of hear a bat or hear a, you know, indigenous animal. It's still a very exciting thing. So. Mm-hmm.
Are there other animals that you see as readily as you see the bats?
Wombats.
Wombats
are everywhere as well. They only come out at night. Uh-huh. They're very docile, beautiful creatures, but a bit of a pest because they wreck the trees and they get into your houses and run amok.
But, really?
Yeah.
Now, what about the classic kangaroo?
Kangaroos is a bit of a topic at the moment. Certainly in Canberra, where the government is, there's a real kangaroo problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've read a little bit about that here.
Yeah, so they've kind of initiated a bit of a cull, which has caused a lot of uproar. Mm-hmm. But certainly in Victoria, it seems to be a balanced kind of community of kangaroos, and they're still kind of regarded as, you know, an iconic sort of Australian mm-hmm. symbol and with an endearing way. But there is a movement in the meat industry to try and encourage top chefs to use kangaroo in their restaurants mm-hmm. to help address the kangaroo issue. Mm-hmm. But it's not getting a lot of
not a lot
positive
of traction.
Reaction, no.
I've seen it on a couple of menus. I can't remember where now, but I have seen references to it now and then. And then, of course, what about that cute little koala bear? How are they doing?
Really well. I mean, they're so popular. People will just drive miles to see a koala bear. Mm-hmm. They do get decimated when we have bushfires, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing you can do about that.
Right. And their reputation is that they're really shy. So is it something where you really have to make an effort to see them and spend some time, you know, just waiting?
Yeah, there's actually quite good places along the Great Ocean Road. They have a koala lookout area. So people would drive and park nearby and walk through a rainforest and mm-hmm. you'll see the koala bears sort of hanging out. But they're very docile and they are shy, but they're quite entertaining when you do find a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember as a little kid, a zoo, it must have been the San Francisco Zoo, even though I remember it as the San Diego Zoo, they got a koala exhibit. And I remember begging my mother to take me, and I finally got to go. And it was just there was a eucalyptus grove, and there they all were up in the trees.
They're very beautiful creatures, and like I say, very docile, and always with child, so to speak, and they're always sort of nurturing their mm-hmm. their little ones. So it's always quite a spectacle when you see one.
Mm-hmm. Morgan, do you have memories of the wildlife of Australia from when you lived there?
Yeah, of course. I remember my grandparents and their backyard had a family of koala bears living in their trees.
Really?
And every time
wow.
I would go and visit, we would, you know, leave the food out for them, and kookaburras, you'd feed them, you know, out of your hand. And the wildlife there is so spectacular and nothing like you'd ever find in the United States. Mm-hmm. Very rare and unique to see.
Yeah, unique, part of the unique sense of place. Mm-hmm. Now, tell me some about viticulture in that area. And both of you, just jump on in. I mean, you're with a restaurant, you're involved in using local wines, I assume,
yes.
and cooking, you know, in such a way that it flatters the local wines and incorporating local wines into cooking. So,
well, the Yarra Valley is located about an hour outside mm-hmm. of Melbourne, and it's one of the most popular wine regions in Australia. And it just is very beautiful. It's actually very similar to Napa Valley, weather-wise, and grapes that are grown there. Cool nights, cooler winters, and it's a nice escape, like San Francisco to Napa. It's same kind of distance, and it's unique to be in such a cosmopolitan city as Melbourne, and then to be able to drive the 45 minutes, hour to the Yarra Valley and taste taste some amazing, spectacular wines and see these rolling hills with vineyards on them. So it's a beautiful sight, and to have wines located so close, you know, it's always neat.
Mm-hmm. And where's the, is that where the Pinot Noir is coming from?
That's where we source our Pinot Noir for our sparkling wine, yes. It's a perfect region for, you know, with the cooler weather and the climate and the rolling hills.
Mm-hmm. And we certainly see a lot of Australian wines here, but I think people are more familiar with Shiraz, for example. Mm-hmm. Shiraz, Chardonnay mm-hmm. are the two that I see most often. Mm-hmm. So we also see them as very much a bargain. You know, Australian wines are almost always much less expensive than California wines. Mm-hmm. What's up with that?
That's interesting. Yeah, I think probably we have a really good climate and the yield's pretty good, hence why we can kind of price it aggressively, I guess. And also the strength of the dollar also impacts that.
Yes,
also.
There's that, certainly. And Australia is just, it's a really big place. And I've always assumed that one of the reasons that is that vineyard acreage probably costs a lot less, say, than it does in Napa, and at this point even Sonoma. Is that a fair assumption to make?
Yes, very much so, yeah. Certainly land's a lot cheaper, yeah. Uh-huh.
But obviously with the popularity of Australian wines now, you go to the Yarra and you go to the Barossa Valley, and they used to be little old country towns, and Hunter Valley as well, and you mom-and-pop shops and very laid back, and now the tourism and the popularity of Australian wines is changing that and bringing more tourists in, which is a good thing, and bringing more focus on the wine. But, you know, they're not so country towns anymore.
Mm-hmm. Really just growing up around the wine industry.
Exactly.
Well, it sounds like it if it's like where the wealthy live around Melbourne. What would you say agriculturally, if this is a fair way to frame it, are ingredients that you find in Australia that you might not find here? I mean, certainly you're talking about the populations and spices and flavorings of the various, you know, cuisines represented there. But what about the agriculture and what grows?
I think California has got very similar sort of climate and interest in food, so there's not a lot of differences.
Okay, so it's just really similar to here.
We have some sort of unique native ingredients, like native finger limes. I think you have those here.
Finger limes?
There's a picture of them in the book. They're as big as I guess, like a cucumber or a gherkin, or a pickle, you call them here in the U.S., and the flesh is like caviar. It's like a citrus caviar.
They're so beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I love those.
That sounds really, really... I'm a great fan of anything citrus.
Yeah.
So there's
a couple of things, and a couple of native spices with the indigenous kind of Aboriginal connection, which you wouldn't have here.
And what are those?
Things like lemon myrtle and wattle seed and... Bush pepper...
Tell us
bush
about
tomatoes.
So are these just wild?
Yeah, they're wild ingredients which the Aboriginals have been eating for centuries, and now have been introduced into our sort of culinary world, I guess. They're not available in the supermarket or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But wattle seed's very similar to coffee, but it's more floral than a sort of coffee bean, so it's quite light.
And how would you use that?
Well, you use it in dessert application generally. But it's good with savoury usage, like coffee is with things like duck and lamb and game. But it's quite a lighter flavour of coffee.
Uh-huh. No, that's interesting. That's something I've never heard of. And what about the bush tomatoes?
Well, they're very small tomatoes, almost like an olive, but the flavour's really intense, like a sort of cherry almost.
Now, are they indigenous to that area?
They are, yeah. You generally find them in the sort of warmer parts of Australia.
And are they... actually a tomato, a true tomato?
Yes, they are.
Oh, interesting, because you hear about the original plants down in, I think, Peru and that area, where you trace back the genetics, and they were wild, they were in a bush, and they were very, very small, but not sweet. And so you always think that is where the first tomatoes were, but it sounds like there's also one in Australia, which I didn't know
They're probably
about.
Very similar, yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's interesting. I would love to try those sometime. And then lemon myrtle.
Yeah, lemon myrtle, like its description, it's a lemony flavour. It's like a lemon leaf, like a lime leaf, but lemon. Yeah. So you have that lovely aromatic sort of citrus flavour. You use it in curries and things like that.
Mm-hmm. You're making me hungry. That's always a really good thing on Mouthful. So where did you grow up? You grew up in England?
Yes, in London, and trained and worked in sort of London's best restaurants and hotels. Uh-huh.
Now, before you got to that age of deciding that you were going to work in food as your career, what was it like when you were growing up? Did you have a really influential relative, your mom, grandma, dad, somebody who really influenced you that way?
Very much so. Our neighbour was a sort of leading chef in London, Spanish man, a very generous, warm fella, and had a beautiful family, and our families used to holiday together in Spain and just sort of hang out, and they always cooked exotic food. And English food 20 years ago was pretty bland and pretty safe, and you know, as you probably know, the sort of stories of overcooked beef and fish and chips, etc.
Yes, but then you also have Yorkshire pudding, which I think makes up for almost all the ills.
Made well, it's delicious, that's right. Yeah. Finding a good one is a hard one.
Ah, okay. And come to my house sometime. I make a mean Yorkshire pudding. So did you cook with this man? Did you cook as a child?
Very much so. I started cooking when I was 14. I was working in the hotel when I was 14. Mm-hmm. And I worked there at the weekends and just sort of see if I liked the culture of a big hotel kitchen, and really, which I did, obviously, and did a lot of Spanish cookery, and then got exposed to really exotic ingredients. So I guess that's where the enthusiasm started.
Mm-hmm. And from there, where did you go?
Well, Mando was very sort of generous with his time, and he was well connected in London, so he would steer me throughout my career to different top chefs. Mm-hmm. You didn't really need a CV, you just kind of made a phone call, mm-hmm. and then you go to the most progressive restaurant. Mm-hmm. So I stayed in London for 10 years, and then I worked for Terence Conran, who's or Sir Terence Conran, as he's known in England, who's a famous designer, restaurateur, has his own sort of label, Conran, and he opened a restaurant in Australia in a retail store called George's in Collins Street, which is a famous street in Melbourne for shopping and fashion. Mm-hmm. And he needed the chef to set up the food side of it, and I was working for him in London, so the opportunity to travel and visit another country was there, and fell in love with Melbourne, the lifestyle, the population, because it's vastly different from London. Mm-hmm. It's so beautifully populated, and the produce was incredible, the interest in food was phenomenal, so it worked out from there, really.
Mm-hmm. Have you been there ever since?
I have, yes.
You have? Oh, that's really great. For somebody who wants to visit Melbourne, who maybe wants to go to Australia and visit wineries and eat really, you know, traditional Australian food, do you have any advice for them?
Oh. Well,
Morgan, you too. One of you, jump on in.
Yeah, be open-minded. Go and just enjoy it and kind of flow with it. Melbourne's very much a kind of, I get a European feel a little bit from
very
it. Outdoor cafes, and the wine is very similar, you know, to California wine, whereas you have the Chardonnays from cooler climates and the Syrahs from the hotter climates, mm-hmm. and the restaurants are outdoorsy, and you experience it all in one small little place, you know.
Yeah.
Melbourne's not the smallest of cities, but it's very well connected. And
it sounds like it's a real crossroads of sorts with lots of different...
It's very informal. Uh-huh. You'll have great food on every level. It's not like some cities, the only good food is really expensive food. The cafes are fantastic. Mm-hmm.
What about street food? Does Australia in general have much of a tradition of street food? Like, say, certainly Malaysia, Mexico, everywhere but America, I think.
Aussie meat pies?
Yeah, that's
Aussie meat pies? Tell us.
Yeah, I mean, the Australians love their pies, yeah. It's AFL, it's a football thing. You know, you have a 4-20 pie. It's the brand. It's very Australian.
Uh-huh. It's like you'd have a hot dog at a football game here. You would go to a football game in Australia and have an Aussie meat pie.
Really? And could you describe it?
Well, it's kind of reminds me of the English sort of pie and mash. You know, it's a real soft pastry.
Is it like a pasty?
Yeah, it's got a lid and it's got. So it's traditional, very traditional, and the filling's kind of old-fashioned, sort of thickened gravy.
Oh, so like steak and kidney
exactly
pie and those
right.
sorts of things.
Just like a steak and kidney.
Yum.
Yeah.
Shepherd's pie.
Yeah, now we're talking about some of my favorite things.
Yeah.
Okay, and so those are casual foods, stalls on the street.
They're in some parts of Australia, they have vans, and you have a pie van, and you have a pie floater, where you have your pie, and then you have your mashed potato on top and your gravy, and it's called a pie floater.
And some chips on the side.
Yeah.
That sounds really, really good. I love street food. I love going out to market, the night markets, or the taco stands and taco carts in Mexico. So I always like to know what's going on, you know.
Very similar.
In the open air restaurants, you could say. There was something else I was going to ask you along those lines, and it flew out of my head like a little bird, so we'll have to think of something else until it flies back. What do people do for fun? You're going out to eat. What other sorts of entertainment is there that pretty similar to here? Going to hear music, hanging out in a pub?
Yeah, I mean, Melbourne's got a great sort of artistic influence. There's always something happening. It's a real city of events.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go to the theatre, you can go to see a musician. It's a very sporting influenced city. Cricket or the football is mm-hmm. on either time of the year.
Yeah, no, is football what we call soccer?
No, AFL. Aussie rules.
Oh, okay.
Which is like, I guess, like cross between rugby and soccer, but like Gaelic football.
Oh, okay. I'm a novice when it comes to all that stuff.
It's a very unique game.
Uh-huh.
And it's very uniquely Australian, I think. I don't think you'll see it anywhere else in the world, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But it makes perfect sense for Australia.
Everything down there is focused on, I think, food, wine, and sports.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mainly,
that's
know,
right.
Everywhere
food,
you go.
Sports. Okay, interesting. I know what I was going to ask. The Aboriginals and that culture, how intermingled, how much influence do the cities, visit tourists, that sort of thing, how much intermingling is there, exposure, access to Aboriginal cultures?
Certainly... As a person who's new to Melbourne, relatively 10 years I've been there now, you don't really see. It seems like it's a very kind of very much part of the community. It's not certainly in Melbourne. You don't see too many Aboriginal people, to be honest with you.
Okay.
You tend to see them more up north in Darwin.
Uh-huh, okay.
But it's very integrated. It's kind of something Australia's proud of.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. So certainly, what we hear, there's always. See a lot of interesting stories about Aboriginals, Aboriginal culture incorporated maybe into things on public television and sometimes in movies. But I've never—it always seems very separate, you know, out away from the cities and cultures, and just very, very separate. So I haven't known like how close, even geographically, the populations are.
Yeah, I think it varies from city to city.
Okay.
Certainly, the warmer you go, and
the so you look more for warmer areas.
Absolutely, Northern Territories is generally where the Aboriginal communities are.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, do you get snow where you are?
We do. Yeah.
You do. You get snow.
Good skiing in Victoria.
Oh, that's excellent. I always think of Australia as very, very hot, but it's nice to know there are very cool regions.
You could get all four seasons in one day
you
in
can.
Melbourne.
So. In one day.
That's right. So very true. Dilemma, not knowing what to wear, because it will change that quick.
Wow, that's so interesting. That's like being in Hawaii. You can go, say, on Big Island, you can go from the beach where it's really warm and there's no wind. You can drive 30 minutes up to Waimea and it's cold and windy and foggy. And then if you're so inclined, you can then drive up Mauna Kea and up to 14,000 feet and then hike up and you're in snow.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do all that within an hour and a half to 2 hours. It's like whiplash when it comes to the weather. We will be right back here on Mouthful. To the book, which is what brought you to the United States. Have you been here before?
I've been to America a few times, I guess promoting Victoria. We have this great sort of Tourism Victoria body which takes guest chefs out to the US to promote our food and our wine.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been to New York and Philadelphia and Hawaii, and this is the just come back from Epcot, the largest food festival in the world at Orlando.
Yeah, John Ash is from he goes every year.
Fabulous man.
Yeah, he's been going, I think, every year since it began. I saw him the day after he got back. Big place, that, and
unbelievable.
Epcot.
Yeah.
So what about Sonoma County? What about wine country?
I'm going out to the Napa tomorrow. I've just been in the city this mm-hmm. week and had some great meals and been really impressed with the quality of the ingredients, mm-hmm. and the chefs seem very confident just to cook very simply, which is a reflection of the amazing produce you have here.
Mm-hmm. And then you're going to see Napa Valley. You're going to spend any time in Sonoma?
Hopefully, yeah.
Should try to somebody should get you to the coast through the Russian River Valley and then out to the coast. It's really gorgeous out there, and I think some of the really great wines produced in this area are coming from Russian River Valley and from Sonoma Coast. But I like those really cold, crisp climate sort of wines. So here's something else I'm looking at. Heirloom tomato tarts with buffalo mozzarella. Is anybody making buffalo mozzarella down there?
Yeah, we have buffaloes in Victoria. A chap brought them out from Italy.
Uh-huh.
And we have real buffalo milk mozzarella. It's a Victorian product we're proud of.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's really great. Do you know if it was a difficult process getting the animals there? I know people have tried to do that here in the United States, and there have been many, many hurdles to surmount to try to make that happen.
I imagine it was a difficult process, but look, it's going great guns to
continue. It is.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the product's just as good as what you have in Italy. The problem is we have to pasteurize all our cheeses in Australia.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, which does affect cheeses like mozzarella.
Sure.
They're not quite as creamy.
Mm-hmm.
But the climate is very similar to the regions in Italy where buffaloes kind of roam, I guess, and so the milk is really sweet. They love the lush pastures of Victoria. We have quite a lot of rain in Victoria, so the pasture's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like there were probably fewer governmental hurdles, because we don't really have something. I keep hearing about various herds that are going to come into production, and then you never hear anything about them again. And I've known there was a really big, beautiful herd in was it outside of Victoria in British Columbia? Yes, it was outside Victoria, British Columbia. Beautiful herd of animals, and they were destroyed through government order. It was very sad. So we haven't really gotten as far as I wished we had. What about your oysters? What are you, this beautiful-looking dish here, native flat Angasi oysters with spinach and spiced cheese gratin. Tell me about the oyster industry there.
Well, Victoria itself, Melbourne, doesn't produce any oysters, but the rest of Australia does.
Mm-hmm.
And they're quite different from state to state. So in New South Wales, you have beautiful rock oysters. We call them Sydney rocks. And then Tasmania has got a lovely cool climate, so a lot of our cool climate wine. It's a very similar culture to Scotland or Ireland.
Oh,
very
nice.
Mountainous and pristine water.
So
you have amazing Pacific oysters from Tasmania. And then South Australia, where you have, again, really beautiful water, warm climate. You have Pacific oysters from Coffin Bay and other areas. So there's a real interest in oysters. People eat oysters like, I guess, you'd eat French fries here. They're very, very common. And everyone's quite comfortable eating oysters.
And so am I. You're giving me more and more reasons to think I should try to pay a visit to Australia. Now, just turn the page, and there is something quite vivid visually. Poulet vert, green chicken. And this looks like two whole roasted chickens with something slathered on them that makes them positively, vividly Kelly green.
That's right. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I guess when you write a book, you want to have some recipes which can be cooked at home. And I felt a roast chicken would be a great one for everyone to cook.
Everyone needs to know how to cook a great roast chicken at home, and I think more and more people are learning that.
And there's a lot of roast chicken recipes out there, and I think everyone's got their own version of doing a roast chicken. So it was kind of bit of fun, really, and Howard come up with a new chicken recipe. And we have this mother sauce we call sauce verte or green sauce in the restaurant we use for a lot of marinades, and we felt it would be a great marinade for a chicken. And so we just basically bath this chicken in this salsa verde or green sauce, which mm-hmm. is a sauce made out of pureed parsley, tarragon, basil, chervil, Dijon mustard, capers, extra virgin olive oil, mint.
Oh, so it's very much like the salsa verdes that you see in the Mediterranean.
Yes, exactly. Just a little
but
bit more
pureed.
Liquid.
Yeah,
more liquid.
Pureed. Because the chicken looks like it's shellacked and green.
It is, yeah, uh-huh. No, absolutely. And it's a form of brining, but using the fragrant
but
herb.
Use it in that sauce.
Yeah.
Right. How long would you leave the chicken in it?
As long as you like, 24 hours.
Really?
You know, is ideal. Yeah.
And then do you then wipe it off and roast it?
No, you just pop it in the oven.
Oh, okay.
And you form a lovely crust on the chicken, as you can see.
Oh, so that is a hard crust. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to try this really soon. That just looks fascinating. Really, really fascinating. What would you recommend drinking with that? Or if you want to do that, Morgan, you can jump
Morgan's
in as well.
More of an expert on that than I am.
I can't say I've ever had it. It sounds fabulous. I mean, Australian Chardonnay, Greg Norman Estates makes a beautiful Chardonnay mm-hmm. from the Eden Valley, which is kind of a crisper, cooler Chardonnay, not heavily oaked. Probably go very well with the delicate herbs in that. Even a nice, beautiful Pinot Noir.
Mm.
We have a California Pinot Noir from Santa Barbara, actually.
And from what vineyard down there?
It's near the Fiddlestick Vineyard.
Okay.
Do you know? Down
yeah.
that area. So, you know, I think really with those herbs and those flavors and the lemon, and you could go either a nice Chardonnay or a beautiful Pinot.
Well, I really recommend getting this book and trying that recipe. It looks intriguing. I'll tell you what happens when I do it. Speaking of Pinot Noir, how would you compare the Australian Pinot Noirs, both flavor, bouquet, and body-wise, to some of the ones, say, from Santa Barbara or Russian River?
Yeah, I think, you know, Australia and California are so similar in uh-huh. so many regards that the Pinots are very similar. You don't find them over here that often, an Australian Pinot Noir, mm-hmm. probably because the focus is more on the Shiraz and the Chardonnays
mm-hmm.
from
yes,
Australia.
Exactly.
So if you do find an Australian Pinot Noir, it's going to be very similar to a Santa Barbara or even a Sonoma Coast that you're talking
about. Okay, so is it going for the lighter style?
It is. It's
excellent.
More Burgundian, especially
yeah,
Victoria, Yarra Valley is more of a Burgundian style of winemaking and the climates and the varietals that are grown there. So it's very similar.
And when you do find them, can you expect them to be similarly inexpensive price as others?
You know, I haven't really, when I drink an Australian wine, I really go for the heavy Shiraz.
Oh, okay.
I grew up on that.
Uh-huh.
The few Pinots that I have been able to find over here from Australia mm-hmm. Probably would be in $15 range.
Yeah, that's, you know, so Pinot Noir has become such a thing and it's so expensive mm-hmm. so much of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always looking for a really good under $20 Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
Okay, moving along through this book, we've talked a little bit about the peppered steak. Here's a gorgeous picture of it. Do you have any recipes for kangaroo?
A journalist asked me that before I left, talking about, you know, the kangaroo problem and if I could help, you know, cooks at home with recipes for kangaroo. And it's very similar to venison.
Yes, that's what I thought.
And it's best eaten sort of cooked very briefly and eaten rare.
Okay.
It's very lean meat.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. So I would recommend serving it with, you know, a sort of red wine sauce, a red fruit sauce, sweet and sour flavors. Pepper the venison first to give it a bit of character. Sorry, the kangaroo, pepper it first. But, you know, I'm not a big fan because I just can't get my head around eating a kangaroo, I'm afraid.
I understand completely, believe me. Definitely understand. So we talked a little bit about the buffalo milk, mozzarella. What about the cheese industry in general? Is there much of a cheese and dairy industry in Australia?
Huge, yeah, absolutely. They always, like I guess everyone does with things like cheese and wine, that we look to France and mm-hmm. recreate the same styles of cheese okay. as France and Italy. They're not as good as the French or Italian, I have to say. And the cheesemakers will say that too. Just our kind of health bodies are just too restrictive in how you process cheeses, and you can't have sort of that mould element.
You can't.
It's you have to have a lot of penicillin in the cheese making, so you have a very thick rind that does take a lot of flavour away. So it's unfortunate, but we have a great interest in cheese, and we import a lot of cheese.
Are you able to import the cheeses that you can't put the style?
I mean, no raw milk, unfortunately.
No raw milk cheeses. No. Oh, that is too bad.
Yeah, there's a big lobby at the moment with chefs and restaurateurs to really change that law.
Oh, well, good luck to you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going on all over the world, trying to make raw milk cheeses utterly illegal. And that would be such a loss. And I know that there are various people in various parts of the world working to prevent that from happening. Okay, how about for our last recipe that we talk about? We dig in, so to speak, to this gold leaf chocolate cake. After what you said about Melbourne being the home of very wealthy Australians, this looks like something designed for them. Is this real gold leaf?
Yes, it's 23 carat gold leaf, yeah, which you buy from specialty food stores. Mm-hmm. And it's edible, and it's, you know...
Yeah, it's edible.
Doesn't have a lot of flavour, but I guess it's quite appealing to some.
Certainly appeals to the eye. It's a very thin chocolate cake. Well, it looks very thin from here, like a thin, dense cake with...
Yeah, it's a flourless
cherries,
chocolate cake.
So, flourless chocolate cake. Is it popular in the restaurant?
Very popular. It's, one of those dishes we can't take off the menu.
Really?
It's a good birthday cake, too.
Sure.
You know, if you're celebrating and someone gives you a cake covered in gold, it kind of makes you feel special, doesn't it?
Anything chocolate, too.
That's right.
It's nice.
Well, this is great. I'm really so happy that you were able to take the time to include KRCB as one of your stops. And the book is available in the United States now?
Yes, it is, yeah.
And who is it from? Who's the publisher?
Hardy Grant. They're our sort of major publisher in Australia. They're a Victorian-based publisher.
And the price is, because you don't put it in the same place that we do. We usually have it on the inside cover jacket, and I'm not seeing the price.
It'd be about $85 here.
$85 here. Mm. Hardcover, gorgeous photography, Inside the Iconic Brasserie Botanical by Paul Wilson. So just check online. If you can't find it, go to your local bookstore, and if they don't have it, they can order it for you. How do people get Norman Wines? Do you have a tasting room open to the public?
Greg Norman Wines are distributed throughout the United States. Mm-hmm. So pretty much a lot of liquor stores, Safeways in certain states will have them, specifically the Australian lines, the Chardonnay that we spoke of, and the Shiraz are very well available for everyone out there.
Probably can find them at places like Bottle Barn and Beverages and More here in Sonoma County as well.
Of course.
What about a tasting room?
We actually don't. Since we are split between Australia and California, we just distribute out country clubs, restaurants, and liquor stores. We supply them to.
Okay. And website?
Shark.com. Shark.com.
Shark?
Yes. My father, Greg Norman, Great White Shark. So he's got numerous divisions of the business, and Great White Shark Enterprises will oversee the Greg Norman Estates wine.
Okay, so shark.com to check out Greg Norman Estate Wines. And is there a website for the restaurant?
Yes, www.thebotanical.com.au.
.com.au.
.au for Australia.
.au. Okay, and if you can't find if you don't find it that way, you can always just put botanical plus Melbourne into Google, and you'll probably get right there. Well, congratulations on the book. I hope you enjoy all the rest of your trip.
Thank you for having us today.
And hope you get to see a lot more of the North Bay. It's a wonderful place before you head back, and who knows, maybe I'll see you there sometime. Morgan, thank you very much for joining in on this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to get to talk to you. Be sure to tune in next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful of Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. Our guest then is going to be Marie Simmons. She has a new book out, Things Cooks Love, written with Sur La Table and the various cooks. Toys, beautiful ones. So we'll be talking to Marie for the whole hour next week.
To the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner now. Let's go.
Support for Mouthful on KRCB comes from our members and from NetBooks, complete business management software for companies up to 50 people, including wineries and food producers. Information available at netbooks.com or by phone at 86NETBOOKS. And from Traverso's Gourmet Foods and Wine, a family-owned purveyor serving customers for over 85 years with domestic and imported edibles and beverages in an old-world atmosphere in downtown Santa Rosa and online at traversos.com. We also have support from Peter Lowell's Cafe in Sebastopol, offering casual dining in the rustic Italian tradition, featuring seasonally sourced organic produce, serving brunch Saturday and Sunday with a farm prefix menu Sunday evening. Peter Lowell's Cafe, online at peterlowells.com.
Listen to what the preacher says, to the Lord that praises me. It's time for dinner, now let's go eat. We got some beans and some flip cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says, to the Lord that praises me. It's time for dinner, now let's go.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.
Now let's go.